I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
I started recording because I realized that if I died, I wanted to have a good story to tell. And a story that would echo on and show people that there is a serious issue in this country that people need to face, take a long, hard look at, and realize blood is being spilled on the floors of American classrooms. And that is not acceptable.
And that is David Hogg, a student at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, speaking to the Washington Post after a rampage shooting at his school on Wednesday that he recorded on his phone. Nicholas Cruz, a former student at the school, has been charged with 17 counts of premeditated murder and reportedly confessed. We are learning more about what happened on Wednesday and about Cruz's troubled past. We asked Jennifer Messia, engagement writer at The Trace, to join us. The Trace is an independent nonprofit news organization dedicated to expanding news coverage of guns in the United States. And Jennifer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what happened in the court yesterday?
Well, Nicholas Cruz was charged with 17 counts of murder, and he was denied bond, which is not a surprise. It's rare that we have mass shooters that survive. Usually it ends in suicide. A couple of times in the past decade, like with Aurora, Colorado, we've actually had trials, Dylann Roof, and it's it can be very revelatory. And in a way, it provides a sense of closure that a suicide just doesn't.
Well, because he can be interrogated or certainly questioned about his motivation.
Mm-hmm. And he seems to have confessed, according to law enforcement sources, even though it seemed that he wanted to escape. He blended in with students after the rampage, put his gun down, blended in with students, and then went to get a drink and stop by McDonald's. There are a lot of details about this that are extremely disturbing, and that is one of them.
Certainly. And apparently there was a police officer on the street that saw him walking and realized that this was mm-hmm. the person that people were looking for.
Yes, indeed. It kind of boggles the mind that he thought, maybe for a second, that he could get away with it. I really am curious to see what was going on there.
He took an Uber to the school. Can you, I guess, reconstruct in part what happened on Wednesday?
Well, according to the timeline, he took an Uber to the school. And now this is interesting. He actually subverted the school security system. He chose when they were leaving school. So everybody was filing out. And that's kind of a gray area in school security. Everybody's leaving. Their guards drop, you know. And what he did was he pulled the fire alarm. And that overrode the school's code red security procedure, which is everybody locked in and in classrooms. And he basically, it looks like, wanted the biggest possible crowd.
And this is a large school. My understanding, a school of something like 3,000 students. Was he able to walk inside the building?
Yes, and there are reports, and they're just coming out this morning, that the school resource officer, the armed school resource officer on campus, might not have been around. We know that the resource officer did not have contact with him, and he might have been elsewhere, off campus, somewhere else. Again, it's a security hole, 3 o'clock, you know, everyone's about to leave.
He had a gas mask on. He had a number of rounds of ammunition. He used an AR-15. Do we know how he got this gun?
He bought it legally, February of 2017, 1 year ago, at a gun shop in Coral Springs. And he did not have any prohibiting factors, which would be a criminal history of a domestic violence conviction, or involuntarily committed to a mental institution. The bar on the basis of mental illness, for instance, is pretty high when it comes to gun prohibition.
There's a story in The Trace. This was yesterday. Here's why American teenagers can buy AR-15s. Help us understand about, I guess, the difference between buying a long gun or an AR-15 and buying a handgun.
Well, it's strange. Long guns, you know, rifles, shotguns, the regulations for those are more relaxed than handguns usually. Handguns are concealable. Of course, assault-style rifles are different. They're a different level of lethality, but they still qualify as long guns. You have to be 21 to get a handgun in Florida, and most counties do have a waiting period for handguns. But for long guns, before you can even take a sip of beer legally, you can walk out with an AR-15, and it's like that in most states.
The idea that you have to wait to 21 to drink, but not to get an AR-15?
Yes. Yes. I know. It seems strange to many people. And until these things happen, those things aren't really pointed out. And now we all have a chance to digest exactly what that means.
Help us. We're learning more about Nicholas Cruz. I think I'm not going out on a limb here to say that he had a troubled life. He was adopted by, along with his brother. His father had died a number of years ago. His mother, who he apparently was rather close to, died in November. What do we know about him so far?
We know from a lot of people he had behavioral problems at school. He was unmoored by his mother's death, it seems. We know that he has family up in New York. He was disconnected. I hear that word a lot in the coverage. He was not connected. People did try to reach out. He received some mental health care over a year ago, but the same word kept coming back. We can't connect with him. And he was truly alone.
Do we know why he was expelled?
Disciplinary issues. I know that at one point I saw reported that he had bullets in his backpack. What's funny, though, is a lot of the students said they used to joke, if anyone's going to shoot up a school, it's going to be him. Of course, not even thinking that that would actually happen at their school.
And apparently there was an email by a teacher, this is even before Wednesday, saying that if he were seen on campus, that people were to do something about it.
Yes, he must have been there. And I'm sure we'll get more details as the days go by. He must have been a disturbance whenever he did come around. And also a neighbor saw him having target practice in his backyard. He had a fascination with guns, and it seems that school administrators got a whiff of that. And again, we'll get more details as the days go by.
There's been some controversy about the numbers of school shootings this year alone. Some have said it's 18. The Washington Post had a really, I thought, interesting and maybe corrective article. No, there haven't been 18 school shootings in 2018. That number is flat wrong. And they go to how a school shooting is defined, quote, anytime a firearm discharges a live round inside a school building or on a school campus or grounds. That's how every town defines a school shooting. How do you see that?
You know, we at the Trace don't exactly have a set policy. What we do is describe it very literally. We noted that there have been, you know, I think 11 incidents, I'm sorry, 14 incidents this month since the beginning of the year where a bullet discharged on the school grounds. And if we were to, you know, report school shootings that resulted in injury and death, we would say that specifically. You know, it's funny that in these things, when it comes to mass shootings, school shootings, there aren't set definitions that we've all agreed on, you know, in the media, law enforcement. So we try to be as specific as possible.
In Florida, there is a child access prevention law. Now, of course, he was not a child, but nonetheless, what are the laws in Florida having to do with gun ownership, the purchasing of guns, background checks, carry laws, things like that?
Well, I mean, Florida does have some waiting periods in some counties for handguns. And honestly, it's in terms of background checks, it pretty much mirrors the federal system, you know, criminal history, felonies, domestic violence, and mental health. And it's for carry laws. I don't know that he had a concealed carry permit. Wow. I haven't seen that reported. But, you know, if you don't have a criminal record, you can buy a gun in a private sale. And that is not covered under the Brady background check. A lot of people don't realize. And about 22% of gun transactions, it has been estimated, are not through federally licensed dealers. So there's an unregulated space there. And that's always been a hole in the system.
Do we know how many people in Florida own guns?
There are estimates, and I'd have to look that up, but the truth is there is no accounting. And that's on purpose. You know, gun rights advocates have fought for years against the idea of a list of gun owners or databases because they feel that it's a step toward confiscation. So for that reason, there's a lot of parts of the system that don't talk to each other. And that's true in many states.
He did have this AR-15, and apparently the family that took him in after his mother died said, you can keep the gun, but you need to lock it up. And apparently he had a key to be able to unlock it. Do we know anything more about this family?
I don't at the moment. You know, I'm really honestly focusing on, you know, how he got the gun. I mean, he was an adult,
right,
like you mentioned. And Florida does have some penalties for guns that are left around children. They do, and a lot of states don't. But, you know, it's misdemeanors, fines. You know, if you're an adult, there is no federal law requiring anybody to lock up a gun. And that's a sad fact. And the more adults who have guns, the more likely they are to get into the hands of children. And, of course, you know, he was an adult. So,
what do you think? What would have prevented this, do you think?
Well, if in other countries, the process to own a gun is more rigorous. Other things are taken into account. And if he had some mental health treatment, perhaps, you know, that could have been incorporated in a background check. But under law in this country, it's not. What could have prevented this? A lot of people argue that these weapons, such as the ones he used, should not be available to civilians. They were created for the battlefield. That's something that's come up in the popular conversation again. The truth is, they say now the background check system didn't work. The background check system, many say, needs to be strengthened. It's not working because it's got a lot of gaps. That perhaps could have helped. Of course, I can't say exactly what the magic solution is or would have been. It's very difficult.
We're almost out of time here. What would you like to ask him, Nicholas Cruz?
Wow. What happened that the complete and total destruction of life was the only answer for you? That's something that I would love to ask him.
Well, Jennifer, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Jennifer Massia, engagement writer at The Trace. And The Trace is an independent nonprofit news organization, and they are dedicated to expanding news coverage of guns in the United States. And obviously talking about what happened Wednesday in Florida, the mass shooting at that school. But we need to also keep in mind that in many communities, there are daily shootings, murders that don't get the same kind of attention. We have two guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Nicholas Cruz was in court yesterday charged with 17 counts of premeditated murder, who reportedly confessed to Wednesday's rampage shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. There is an all-too-familiar debate and response after these all-too-common incidents of violence about thoughts and prayers that this is not the right time to talk about gun policies. And then we move on until the next mass shooting. But the students at that school are having no part of that. Here's senior Tyra Hemans talking to the Washington Post, and she's holding a poster featuring photos of friends and faculty who were killed.
Students are dying. Children are dying. My friend will never get to say I graduated high school. He's never going to get a high school diploma. He's never going to get a first official job. He's never going to tell his girlfriend, Victoria, I love you again. How can you just live like that? How can you, like, as a president of the United States of America, how can you look at these fellow students and think, okay, it's life, let's just move on? No, my life is forever stopped.
You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me introduce our two guests. Mark Salzer is a psychologist, professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University, also director of the Collaborative on Inclusion of Individuals with Psychiatric Disabilities. Mark, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Joshua Hazelton, and he is a trauma surgeon, director of trauma research, associate trauma medical director, and assistant professor of surgery at Cooper University Hospital, which is across the river in Camden. Joshua, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Mark, let me begin with you and just listening to that student. Obviously, there was a vigil last night, very emotional vigil for students, families, faculty, and people who care about what happened on Wednesday. What do these people need?
First of all, as a parent of children myself, I could not imagine what the parents are experiencing right now. I think what those parents likely need is for people to be there to listen to them, to support them, to talk about their loved one who was taken away from them in such a horrific way. And just be there for them. And it's really the same for the community, including this young student at that high school. The experience of vicarious trauma is a real thing. So that young woman, along with everybody else in that community, including around the whole United States, have really been impacted this. And one strategy that I think is already being implemented is communities are coming together. They come together, they talk about these issues, they look for solutions, they support each other, and talk really is the main thing. How are you doing? What's going on? And to keep talking over time, not to let it slip away and forget about it.
Joshua, one of the reasons we wanted to have you here is that while these mass shootings get, frankly, a lot of coverage, mass coverage, so many communities in Philadelphia, Camden, other cities, really gun violence is a daily occurrence. And I'm thinking about all the young people and their families that you have talked to in the ERs. You're patching them up.
Absolutely.
What do you say?
Absolutely.
What do you say to them?
Sometimes I don't know what to say. But it is. It's a nightly occurrence, certainly in cities like Camden, in Philadelphia. It doesn't just happen in Chicago. It doesn't just happen in East St. Louis. It happens, you know, down the street from here. These patients come in every night. They're shot. They're wounded. They're killed. Their family members are, brought in, and we have to tell them. I have to tell them, listen, your son is dead. That is extremely difficult. So yes, while these terrible tragedies do get national, international coverage, this happens every single day, every single day.
Talk about what happens if someone is shot with an AR-15.
Well, that's very different than what we typically see day to day with gunshot wounds. A typical handgun, a 9mm gun that a police officer would carry or a citizen would carry for personal protection, creates smaller wounds. It does absolutely create damage, tissue damage, moderate destruction as it travels through the body. Unless these hit vital structures and the patient bleeds to death quickly, they can survive for some time and get to a trauma center and get to the operating room, and we can save them. These AR-15s, these assault weapons, are on a different scale. The foot pound of force is multiple times that of these 9mm, these handguns. The wounds are much larger, and they create such destruction as they travel through the body that massive hemorrhage, limb loss is the prototypical wound that you see in these. And
is that why the fatality rates are so high?
The fatality rates are so high. You have a high-velocity weapon that shoots multiple rounds within seconds. These are close-range injuries very often, Las Vegas being a little bit different, but these are typically close-range. And we know from research that done in the trauma community that 75% of these injuries are to the head and chest, which with these types of weapons are almost always fatal.
Mark, let me go back to you. And as I was writing up my questions for today, I remembered being in psych classes and learning about learned helplessness. And this sense, people that I talk to, whether at work or my community, everyone feeling this sense of powerlessness, of helplessness, of upset, of frustration, all the things, feeling you get zapped, but you don't have the kind of control over your environment that would make us feel like we can do something about it. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for us as human beings to really imagine the unimaginable and to try to comprehend that and make sense of it. And that is a situation here. And really, that's one of the reasons I'm here is I'm worried about the potential or the targets for our attempts to try to understand these and blaming people with mental illnesses or blaming mental illness and coming up with laws and policies that target mental illness is really an example of how we try to, explain the unimaginable, rare events that are really difficult to explain.
Well, let me quote something that the president tweeted. So many signs that the Florida shooter was mentally disturbed, even expelled from school for bad and erratic behavior. A number of other people have said it's about his mental illness. That is the explanation for what happened on Wednesday.
So, Marty, there is a connection between mental illness and violence. It's not the connection that people think it is, though. The connection is that approximately 70 or 80% of people with serious mental illnesses have experienced trauma as children. The connection is that as adults, 4 to 7% adults with serious mental illnesses are 4 to 7 times more likely to be victims of violence. The connection is that the majority of adults with serious mental illnesses have experienced verbal violence, being yelled at, being screamed at, being told, being threatened, and that sometimes this can be just as harmful to people as physical violence. And the connection is that, tragically, tens of thousands of Americans commit suicide every year.
Right. Oftentimes with a gun.
Oftentimes with a gun. So that's the connection with violence. The connection that we don't have, which many people, both on the right and the left, liberals and conservatives, don't really seem to be paying attention to, is the demonstrated lack of connection between gun violence and mental illness. Mm.
Let me ask you what we're learning about Nicholas Cruz, the young man who frankly is or reportedly has confessed to these killings, these murders, this mass murder. He was troubled. I mean, I think there's no question about that. He had a difficult childhood for whatever reason. He was expelled from school for reasons that we don't entirely understand, but obviously there were problems at school. Reports about him being a nuisance in his neighborhood, even from time to time hurting animals. As you understand him, and obviously from afar, what do you see? Who do you think he was?
So first of all, I'll say that it's very clear that there have been incidents in our country where people who clearly seem to have a very significant mental health issue have committed these kinds of acts. That's very clear. But what I'm most concerned about is that people who are somebody's weirdness, somebody who clearly has anger issues, somebody who's clearly violent, that really is the common denominator between all these cases and situations. Among other variables, access to weapons, using these assault rifles, being white male, there are lots of factors going on here. And in general, the relationship between mental illness and gun violence is just not there. We can try to look at a particular case, but trying to draw inferences from a particular case is really a mistake. We were talking earlier about how much gun violence there is in our country. Yeah. 75,000 people are injured every year with guns, 30,000 fatalities every year. That's about 92 people a day are killed. That would be the equivalent of 5 of these school shootings every day. That's really where we need to pay attention to things.
Well, Joshua, let me turn back to you. And again, you know, wanting to make sure that we keep the focus on the more day-to-day violence that sadly is so much a part of our country and our culture. When you talk to young people, either the perpetrator or the victim, or sometimes they're one and the same, what's your impression of what's the root of this violence?
Well, for me in Camden, it's a day-to-day struggle. It's their daily life. It's what they know. It's what they grow up doing. This is a community that in many cases doesn't have other options. There may not be the options for education. There may not be the options for organized sports and other things. It's a unfortunately, and not just in Camden, but throughout the country, weapons are ingrained into our society. Is it a part of American society? So I think that the presence of a gun or owning a gun And even using a gun is not taken as seriously, is not really respected for what those outcomes are. And I think a lot of the violence I see in Camden, and I'm sure this is the same at most level one trauma centers in urban areas, everybody knows someone who's been shot. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows someone who has shot a gun. And it's just part of regular life.
That's sort of living in a war zone.
Absolutely.
The same kind of trauma, stress reactions.
Absolutely. And for some of them, it's a known fact that this is how I need to make a living, whether it's, drugs or violence or gangs. And not saying that that's the only thing, but certainly in many, many underserved communities, that is the day to day.
What does it mean to have a public health approach to the epidemic of gun violence? What does that mean?
Well, for us, at least at Cooper and places like Camden, education about gun safety, education about gun violence, and many times, we have outreach programs through Cooper. But what we find is, sometimes these communities know more about guns than we do. Uh-huh. They know more about the presence. They know more about who has the guns. And I don't think we have a good handle on where these guns are and where the violence comes from. Unfortunately, what we do in my profession is we can't really prevent a lot of these things. We can prevent the death from gun violence, and we hope to do that with early response and good treatment at the trauma center. But we can't prevent that, at least from a trauma center.
You're almost on the receiving end, right?
We are on the receiving end, absolutely.
Mark, you want to add something?
Yeah, I'd like to add to what a public health approach means. And part of a public health approach is not looking at specific incidents. Why did this event happen in Florida? Instead, we need to look at why do we have such a gun violence problem in the United States? That's a public health approach, not looking at these specific incidents and why and trying to come up with explanations and do all those things. We need to really step back and look at the broader factors. And really, those broad factors are really quite clear. And we are policymakers, again, both on the left and the right. This is not a conservative or liberal issue that we're not coming up with the right solutions, focusing at the right level.
You're saying it's obvious. Is it because we just are awash in guns? I mean, the more guns you have, the more suicides you're going to have, the more homicides you're going to have.
We have an unusual addiction in our country, and it's an addiction to guns. When we talk about that connection or lack thereof between mental illness and gun violence, the clearest evidence for this is that rates of mental illness are about the same around the world. Serious mental illness, it's about the same. Yet we have 25 times more gun events, gun killings, than any other country around the world. And the common denominator with that, or the explanation for that, is we have a lot more guns.
Yeah.
And again, I believe in the Second Amendment. I'm not an anti-Second Amendment. I'm not an anti-gun person. But we have a problem, and it's clearly related to guns.
Well, and picking up on that, and there's much we don't know about this family that took in this young man. But for whatever reason, they allowed him to keep this gun. He clearly was a troubled person. I'm thinking about Adam Lanza with the Sandy Hook shooting. He, again, a troubled child. His mother would go shooting with him. And one wonders, Joshua, just about there are corporate and political responsibilities, but also this question about individual responsibility, especially for the adults, for the parents, the grown-ups, the people that are supposed to take care of our children.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. And, you mentioned the access to guns is everywhere. It's part of our lifestyle in this country. Mm-hmm. But is there enough regulation on certain types of guns, certain types of weapons? I think it's disturbing that it takes my fingerprint to open my iPhone, but I can keep an AR-15 in the trunk of my car without any safety mechanisms on it.
And a fingerprint might help.
And a fingerprint might help. I don't know.
Let me get Tom from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Marty. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
The willful ignorance of the American people is absolutely stunning. All these intelligent people you have had on and you have heard all over the country are willfully ignorant. A gun cannot shoot a person without the ammunition. The ammunition is not protected by the Constitution. Every ammunition manufacturer in the United States has to sign, to get their license, has to sign a government paper that says the government can walk in at any time and take your full production. Obama did it. It took 5.5 months to produce 1.5 trillion rounds. We later sold Iraq 10,000 M16s. We sold most of the ammunition to them. But if you control the ammunition...
Okay, well, I'm going to pick up on that. I didn't know if you were going to go on, Tom, but his point is, and I'm putting it to you, Joshua, is it's more about the ammo than the gun. You are a trauma surgeon.
Well, the access to the ammunition, certainly the gun doesn't work without the access to the ammunition. I would make the argument that, again, you know, maybe my personal opinion, that no one needs a gun that can do what some of these assault rifles do. These are military-style weapons. They are designed to be used in combat to kill as many people as quickly as possible. Again, my personal feeling, I don't see any recreational use for that. I don't see any sport use for that. I don't see any hunting use for that, and certainly no personal protection use for that. I've seen what these bullets can do. I've seen what they do when they hit a person. I've seen what they do when they hit a leg or a liver or a head, and it is absolutely devastating. Mm-hmm. And I would challenge people who have never seen that, come to the trauma bay and see what these wounds are, what these injuries are. Talk to the family. Go out and talk to that mother of that child who was just shot. And I think you'll have a difference of opinion. As a father and as a trauma surgeon, you know, again, I just like my colleague, I agree with the Second Amendment. If you want to own a gun, that's fine. You don't need a machine gun. You don't need an assault rifle.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I'm sure, Mark, you want to weigh in on that as well. That's Joshua Hazelton. He is a trauma surgeon, director of trauma research, associate trauma medical director, and assistant professor of surgery at Cooper University Hospital, which is located in Camden, New Jersey, across a river from Philadelphia. Mark Salzer, also with us as well. He's a psychologist. He's a professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University and director of the Collaborative on Inclusion of Individuals with Psychiatric Disabilities, talking about guns and violence and mass shootings and daily shootings as well. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Let's listen to Fred Guttenberg. He lost his 14-year-old daughter, Jamie, on Wednesday's school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Here he is speaking at a vigil last night to a crowd of mourners.
This is makes no sense. This is impossible. My girl, my 14-year-old baby. And for those of you who know my Jamie, she was the life of the party. She was the energy in the room. She made people laugh. And yes, sometimes she made us cry. But she was always known. She always made her presence felt. I sent her to school yesterday. She was supposed to be safe. My job is to protect my children. And I sent my kid to school. In the morning, sometimes things get so crazy, she runs out behind, and she's like, I got to go, Dad, bye. And I don't always get to say, I love you. I don't remember if I said that to Jamie yesterday morning. Parents, love your kids, hold your kids, kiss your kids, and don't ever, ever miss the chance to tell them how much you love them.
That's just heartbreaking to hear, but so real and so important. Mark, you know, you sometimes hesitate to not use, but to replay someone's deep grief and mourning as a way to talk about these things that we've been talking about. But nonetheless, I worry that we get disconnected from the emotional impact that this has on families, on communities, on individuals, schools, on cities.
Well, I would agree. I think, first of all, that that father, what he had to say is something for all of us who are parents and family members and even our friends to keep this in mind every day. And it's also, I'm reminded how many times I've heard a parent say things like that over and over and over again. I mean, we hear it. And, you know, we need to somehow figure out how to remember this. But also not remembering it just after a mass killing. We need to mourn this every day. 92, an average of 92 violent gun deaths every day. We need to remember it. I read the Philadelphia Inquirer every day. Instead of a small little column on the three killings in whatever part of Philadelphia or whatever part of our region, you know, small little area, and I read it and I go, oh, yep, okay, happened again.
Yeah.
We need to remember this every day and pay attention to it and not look for the easy scapegoats, the easy explanations. We need to look for the tough ones and take this on seriously.
This is maybe an unfair question, but you were a psychologist, and again, we're learning more about this young man. There clearly were signs. I mean, it seems that they were people that cared about him, but nonetheless, there were signs. Do you think some kind of a different kind of intervention could have helped him? I mean, it's again, I feel unfair asking you that because you don't know him. You've never treated him. But
yep. Well, let's just take some of the signs that we're hearing about. He was weird. So look, how many of us know people who we think are weird? There are probably, you know, tens of millions American citizens who somebody thinks is weird. That's not cause for intervention necessarily. Right. The major factors that I'm most concerned about are his clear demonstration of anger and violence. This is a young person who said what he was going to do. And
apparently online, right?
We need to pay attention to that. We don't need to say, oh, you know, that's a mental illness or anything like that. When somebody says something like that, we need to act on it. And I would like to see laws or interventions or things where, you know, you just you say something like that, somebody will act. And that's really what we see pretty commonly, again, in a lot of these mass killings, again, that are a small percentage of all gun killings in our country. But there are these hints. They're not necessarily the mental illness hints, not the symptoms that we usually think about it. It's anger and violence.
Yeah. And loneliness. I mean, it felt like this was a, you know, a lonely kid. There are a lot of lonely kids out there. I understand that.
Yep, that's exactly where I was going to go. There's a lot of loneliness, and most of those lonely kids, it's not that they're going to go do something, or lonely adults. It's not that they're going to go do something to somebody else. I would react to loneliness more from a suicide prevention standpoint. How are things going? What's going on with you? What's happening? I'm more worried about that rather than that lonely kid somehow doing something to somebody else.
Josh, anything you want to add to that?
Not necessarily that so much, but I hear that clip of that father and I think to myself, that is a conversation or that is the parent that 3, 4, sometimes 5 times a month, myself or one of my partners is having a conversation with. Right. And that conversation is happening all over the country every single day. Every single day.
I'm still thinking about this public health approach. So how we approach the flu or, you know, other obesity or AIDS. I mean, I'm thinking of all the epidemics that we as a country have to face and as a public, a medical health care system have to face as well. Can we draw lessons from that?
Well, I think we can. I think the difficulty is in preventing these types of incidents. I'm not sure we can come up with a strategy to prevent these types of incidents. I see two issues. One issue is research in this area is poorly funded. Since the late 90s, the CDC has limited funding for firearms research in a fear that the data that we draw from that is going to be used in an anti-gun control policy. So we don't have a good handle on what these types of injuries are. We don't have mandatory reporting of all of these types of things across 50 states. It is a voluntary thing. So we lack research funds in that sense. I think the bigger part that we can do more immediately is to train the public, is to train first responders to limit life loss. If we can't prevent these injuries, these events from happening, at least in the immediate sense, we can prevent the lives lost. We can we can do training with tourniquets and with types of hemostatic dressings that are developed to stop bleeding. At Cooper, we participate in the National Stop the Bleed campaign, which is a White House campaign from 2015 that trains people all around the country in how to stop bleeding in these types of events. 2.3 million people a year get trained in how to do CPR, and we are training only thousands in Stop the Bleed.
Yeah, I know you want to add something, then we'll get to our callers. I want to read a bunch of comments as well. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I'll try to be quick. I actually do think that we can prevent these kinds of things from happening. And one way to do that is to look at other countries and see what they do where they don't have the level of gun violence that we have. Let's look at Canada. Let's look at Australia. Let's look at the United Kingdom. Let's look at these places and see what they have. There's actually a public health approach to doing this. Let's zero in and try to identify those and then mimic those here in our country. So I have confidence that we can do it. But that confidence is decreased every time I hear a governor of a major state where these events happen who says that all we have to do is keep guns out of the hands of people with mental illness, which, by the way, just increases or enhances prejudice and discrimination that has its own harms. This is a harmful type of statement that people make.
Let me read some comments here. How do we get these weapons of mass destruction off the streets? No parent or loved one is immune to this. An email from Lee. Open up HIPAA laws. Police need to know who's taking mind-altering drugs or see doctors for mental illness. A tweet from Jill. Why are we so behind the rest of the world on this issue? People need to realize that the only way things will change is to elect government officials who believe in gun safety. Interestingly, President Obama had to deal with this numerous times, including Sandy and other mass shootings. And there were all these calls for safety regulations and these emotional funerals and memorial services. Nothing happened. Nothing happened, Joshua.
No. And perhaps I'm more of a pessimist, maybe because I see, I see the results of it in my clinical practice every day. If this didn't happen after Newtown, when you had
and first graders,
toddlers, I don't know.
Yeah. Let me get Claire from, looks like, Orland to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Claire. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi there. I'm calling not to justify or in any way forgive the shooter. But when I saw his background, it reminded me of my life because I come from a large family from a very poor area in upstate Pennsylvania, and our mother died when we were young. And it caused terrible, terrible trauma in our family. My three younger siblings, without getting into details, got into some serious, serious addiction and mental health trouble. Fortunately, we did not have access to guns. We had no interest in guns in our family. But there was no help for any mental health issues or addiction issues. And I think perhaps if our mental health culture was less prejudicial and less discriminatory, like the psychologist said, maybe there would have been a way for us to get some help. But these siblings of mine are, to this day, in serious, serious trouble, mentally and with addictions.
Well, Claire.
And I do feel for the young man because his mother and father both died and he had nowhere to go, taken in by a family friend. Who even knows what that means?
Well, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times, a very poignant story. And Mark, from what I've read in the paper, he was rather close to his mother. She died, I think it was November 1st. But Claire's talking about just the trauma of loss and how that can affect a family.
Yeah, I mean, Claire is a really good example of, unfortunately, the millions of people in our country who have experienced trauma and loss, just like apparently this person in Florida, but did not or has not gone on to do this kind of horrendous act. And Claire is actually a perfect example of somebody who apparently did not get mental health treatment, and she did not do anything that I know of, or she didn't mention it, or her siblings. And that is like the overwhelming majority of people who have similar experiences. But I will agree with her point. We don't have enough mental health services in our country. We don't have enough funding. It's not funded at the right level. We're not always targeting the kinds of services that I think are incredibly important, including also supporting people to work and go to school and date and go to church, synagogue, and mosque, have friends, relationships, do things like everyone else. And those types of rehabilitation services are not even close to being adequately funded.
You know, Joshua, I'm thinking about this young man, 18, 19 years old. We know from some of these other mass shootings that they tend to be males of that age. Is there something about just that time in life or the developmental history or even brain development that could help us understand some of this?
Well, do you know? We do know that the brain is not fully developed until, what, early 20s, mid-20s. Childhood trauma and extenuating circumstances to that. I don't know if there's an exact pinpoint cause, and my colleague and I were discussing this before we came on, is, you know, there are millions of people who are dealing with mental illness that we don't hear about. And, you know, in my practice, I see the worst of it. And so it's very easy for me or someone in my position to say, well, it's because of the mental illness, because of this. And we were discussing earlier, I don't know the denominator.
Right.
You know, I see the one or two a week or a few a month, but there are tens of millions who don't go out and do these things.
Before we get back to our callers, so Mark, I mean, are we going to have this same conversation 6 months from now? I mean, one wonders whether we have a government that has the wherewithal or maybe even the expertise, because frankly, I don't know what can be done to prevent this. But what are your thoughts?
Marty, you're breaking my heart saying, might we be here in another 6 months? And I'll just say I hope not. I keep thinking, you know, maybe this is the time where we're going to do something different. But the first thing that needs to happen is we can't keep pointing our fingers at the one incident and one and mental health and mental illness as the factor. That is not the factor. We have evidence about that, and it's steering us in the wrong direction. Huh. And we need to look at other things. We need, again, people across the spectrum to come together and you know, deal with the real issues here and not deal with the, you know, the misguided directions that they could take.
Let me see what Bruce from Westchester has to say. Bruce, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, as a public health policy, I think you could look towards the alcohol problem that was changed in the 80s when some states had 18 years of age for alcohol and some had 21. If we would take guns out of the hands of 18-year-olds and boost the age for gun ownership to 21. It would bring it closer to where the male, since it's just men who shoot, male brain is a little more developed and maybe better decisions would be made for someone who's 21. Having an 18-year-old owning a gun doesn't make any sense to me.
What are your thoughts there, Joshua? You have a slightly quizzical look on your face.
Many of my patients who are shot and are doing the shooting are 14, 15, 16. Mm. These are not regulated guns. I think gun regulation is going to be part of the solution. Many of them, these are not legal guns. These are guns that are not traced. These are guns that are not purchased legally. I've seen children in single-digit ages who have been shot, and I've seen 13, 14, 15-year-olds being the shooters. So while I agree that that may help with some of the legal gun purchases, maybe some of these type of assault weapon purchases, that's not going to solve the public health crisis that we see in Camden, in Chester, in Philadelphia, in Chicago.
Let me read some more comments. A tweet from Jill: why are we so behind the rest of the world? An email from William: please do not overlook medication as a direct cessation to every mass shooting from Columbine to today. An email from Kenneth: do either of you feel a responsibility to stand up against guns as white men and not simply as an American or healthcare professional? An email from Anne Marie: what are these countries like Canada, Australia, England? They have strict gun control, which is what you were referencing earlier. Mark, and I hate to end on this note because we're almost out of time here, are you up against the Second Amendment, though? Those countries don't have our Second Amendment.
I mean, you can say that, but really responsible application or responsible use of the Second Amendment. We have other amendments in our countries where there are limits, and we can do the same with the Second Amendment. And 25 times more likely more gun deaths in our country. That is not reasonable. We need to do something, and everybody should be on board for this.
Mark Sulzer, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Joshua Hazelton, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate all those comments and calls to Radio Times. Obviously an important issue. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show if you want to hear it in its entirety. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.